Welcome to Legal Talk with attorney Kevin Flesh of Flesh Law. Auto accidents, DUIs, slip and falls, each one can change your life. But the trial-tested, trial-ready attorneys at Flesh Law relieve your legal burden. Whether you need to heal from an injury or protect your future in a criminal matter, the legal team at Flesh Law is prepared to defend your rights. Now, here's Legal Talk with your host, Scott Whatley, and attorney Kevin Flesh.
Welcome to Legal Talk. Thank you so much for being with us. Our show is brought to you by Flesh Law. Their number, 303-806-8886. Always a free initial consult. And hey, if you have a question, we have our Flesh Law text line, 720-201-8585, 720-201-8585. And we're coming to you live today from the world headquarters of Flesh Law over here in Englewood. Kevin Flesh, how are you, sir?
I'm good. How are you?
Good, man. Almost halfway through the year.
It's crazy. I don't know how this happens. It's just, you wake up and it's summer. Just
I know. And, I know.
Yeah. I just think about, we've been really busy with all kinds of things, and then it's all good. And clients are happy with the results that we're getting for them. And I had a case that was supposed to go to trial very soon, and we got that case resolved on the eve of trial, and that's frustrating, but it's also good for the client.
Oh, because you put in all that work to be ready for trial, and
And you're kind of like a bridesmaid, you know, you're ready to move forward, and then you don't, you end up resolving it. So it opens up some time, but then you start working on other stuff.
Right.
So it's been an interesting time, and things are good. You know, the insurance companies eventually realize what we tell them is true, and that they got to pay fair value, or we're going to go to trial. And if they don't, then we end up in trial. But most of the time lately, they finally cave at the last minute.
So that's are insurance companies fighting harder than ever? Or are they pretty consistent?
It's pretty consistent. What happens is insurance companies, individual insurance companies, change their strategy almost on an annual basis. They'll try one thing one year where maybe they're really hard at the beginning on the demand stage where their initial claims reps don't have a whole lot of authority to resolve things. And so then you have to file suit against that company quite often that particular year. And then they realize their claims experience doesn't really work that way and doesn't work well because they have a bunch of judgments against them. And so then they rethink how they're going to do it and retool it maybe the next year or 2 years later. So it really depends upon the insurance company and how their management has decided to handle these claims. But for the most part, they're all sort of in the end. When you get into litigation in particular, you get the more sophisticated claims representatives and also the lawyers representing them. And then we can have a real discussion about, especially the larger claims that we handle. Those are normally dealt with folks that have a lot of experience. And when you have folks with more experience, they recognize the risk that they may run.
Right.
And that's where you can have a real discussion with them about value. So
right.
That's good.
Right. Yeah. I don't know if you've been seeing on the news some. It seems like every county is having a big problem with these e-bikes, and not e-bikes, but these e-motorcycles almost.
Yeah.
I mean, and we both have e-bikes.
Yes.
E-Bike of Colorado,
right.
544 Front Street, downtown Louisville. All right. And we know what those bikes will do. Son, some of these kids are riding these bikes. I mean, they're hauling with these kind of e-motor scooters, I think.
They're straight up electric motorcycles.
Right.
We were on Cherry Creek Reservoir, the trail around there, a couple of weeks ago, my wife and I. Yeah, we've got the pedal assist and the e-bikes that you're able to go in those sort of situations.
Mm-hmm.
But you can still get going pretty good.
Yeah.
And we rolled up on a couple of teenage boys. They were probably 14 or 15. And, you know, I said to them, because you could tell, these weren't pedal assist. These were, they had a trigger, they were going. I'm like, so how fast can you go on that? He's like, well, it had a limiter on it when we first got it, so you could only go so fast. But we figured how to get that limiter off. So they can scream.
Yeah.
And they're over 50, 60, 70 miles an hour.
Right.
As a matter of fact, we've had a couple of cases where kids have gotten into accidents where they're crossing intersections or things like that and not paying attention.
Right.
And hit cars.
Really?
Yeah, I've got one right now, man. Where the 16-year-old kid was driving along and a car came out of an intersection he didn't see it, and he ran right into it. The kid did. He was just not paying attention.
Sure.
And it wasn't the driver of the car's fault, and he caused damage to this vehicle. Luckily, he's okay.
Right.
But he got cited from the city of Lakewood for what he was doing.
Yeah.
And I was having a conversation, and I'm having conversations with parents that their kids have these, that I think we're going to see, I would guess, based upon sort of what's going on with not only the citations but also the injuries, that there's going to have to be some limitations. That some of these super, you know, over 1,000-watt bikes that are going to need to be somehow controlled, especially, you know, you have to have a driver's license or something. Because I see them, all the time.
Yeah. And I bring it up because we're going to talk about some things that fall under personal injury, but I bring it up today because some people ask me, well, man, is that the same as car insurance? Would an e-bike or that be treated as a motor vehicle?
No, they're not. So they're going to be more similar to, they're probably going to be under your homeowner's coverage, and you've got to find out whether or not something like that is covered. Many times, like your ATVs and your other things, if they're on premises, are covered. If they're off premises, they may not be. What you're really worried about is the negligence, right?
Right, right.
If somebody gets hurt and it was the fault of the e-bike rider, what do you have for coverage? Because it is not covered under your auto policy. You would have a general liability policy portion of your homeowner's or renter's insurance that you could fall underneath that. And then it may be, if it's finally, if they're determined to be scooters or motorcycles, you'll be able to most likely get coverage for those as well. A separate coverage if you wanted it. So
now, if an e-bike or whatever caused a crash where, two cars and they get the ticket for causing that crash, I mean, that'd be going after
the person that's riding the
e-bike.
Yes. And most likely nobody has coverage for it.
Yeah.
I just finished a case that I was telling you about in Lakewood, where the parents, there was about $6,000 or $8,000 worth of damage to the vehicle that their son had caused, and they had to, their auto, because they tried to run a claim through their auto, because they thought, well, maybe because it's involving a car that we could have it covered, and the auto policy specifically excluded it because it had two wheels, and so they then had to find out if their homeowner's coverage would cover it, and they found out no, it wouldn't cover, so they had to go out of pocket for the restitution.
Wow.
Yeah. And that's something that people need to think about when their kids are out on these sort of, a bicycle is one thing, but when you have the power and speed of these other things, you have to be really concerned. And certainly just for the child in regards to them being hurt, I think a lot of people think of it as, well, it's just a bicycle. But most of these that are that wattage and that there's really no pedal assist and they have a trigger, it's like a regular motorcycle sort of setup. You've created a danger, I think.
Yeah. And as parents, maybe you went and bought it for them and it's supposed to go 30. Go take it for a test ride and see if it only goes 30.
Exactly. You want to make sure
that they might have rigged it up, like you said.
Yep.
And these
kids are figuring it out.
For sure.
Yes.
Well, once again, you're listening to Legal Talk with Attorney Kevin Flesh. He is our exclusive attorney here on KLZ 560. And Kevin handles a lot of things with criminal law, personal injury. And one thing we're going to talk about, because, most of the time, and we're even guilty of this, we talk about personal injury and we talk about, motor vehicle accidents and things like that. But this falls under what we're talking about today, but motorcycles. And Kevin, there are quite a few things that fall under this umbrella of personal injury that you take care of.
There really is. I mean, all of the advertising and what people see out there a lot of times in the billboards and other things is related to motor vehicles or truck accidents or those sorts of things. But we handle a lot of other areas. Whenever you have injuries and those injuries are caused by someone else's negligence, you normally can bring a claim. And so, it could be, we've had it. There's just so many different categories of things. We've had your premises liability. People slip and fall. So you have everything from, being out at DIA and walking through the terminal and there's water in there and there was notice that there was water and you slip and fall and hurt yourself. Dog bites. You're walking through a neighborhood and somebody's dog runs out and bites you on their premises.
Right.
Falling in a pothole in a parking lot, There are so many different ways that people can get hurt, unfortunately, and people create dangerous conditions on premises. So that's sort of the premise liability portion, that many times there aren't people that are specifically advertising for that sort of stuff, but there are lots of people that get hurt in those environments, and we help a tremendous amount of people on a regular basis. I mean, we have a number of cases annually related to, you know, your normal shoveling, not putting ice melt down, or not, you know, falling and those sorts of things. So claims against homeowners associations, against property management companies, against regular commercial vendors, you know, gas stations, convenience stores, all kinds of different places that hold themselves out to the public for services, and they're not taking care of their sidewalks or their entrances of where they're at. And then we have, you know, basic maintenance. I've got a case right now where somebody got hurt in a swimming pool because it was a new pool and they didn't put it together right, and the stairs on the side of the pool fell off of the side of the pool and caused injury. So all kinds of odd things that happen, you know, over time.
In time, you're going to have to write a book.
Yeah.
Dude, I'm just, you know, fun stories.
How people get hurt, the unfortunate sort of the macabre things that happen to people. Right. Yeah, and there, I mean, I had a case last year where a fellow was at a coffee shop, and he was just about to sit in a chair, or he did sit in the chair with his, he had his one finger on the chair in sort of a pinch point, and the chair broke and caused him to lose part of his finger. Mm-hmm. It cut his finger completely off, and we had to decide what his finger was worth. You know, we've had just the strangest cases relating to people doing strange things in strange places.
Right. Now, premise liability, would that mostly be where you ends up going against a business? Is that the large portion of
it? Yeah, generally it's a business claim, but the businesses have their own insurance policy.
What would be something around a house? Do it, a neighbor or something might... Is there anything?
Yeah, so in some instances where individuals or cities have ordinances relating to shoveling snow, where you have to make sure that you do that within 24 hours after a snowstorm or things like that, and you cause problems there. Or if you have something inside of your house that's dangerous, and you have a guest over for some reason.
Yeah. And certainly the dog would fall into this. Yep,
yeah, exactly. And you know, there's... talking about dogs and dog bites, there's a specific statute in Colorado relating to the dog bites. So you have two different sort of categories of damages. You have the dog that has never bitten anyone before and you have no notice, and then that particular sort of claim is most likely just related to your medical expenses and any other economic damages, but you probably don't get much in the way of non-economic damages, so pain and suffering. But if the dog has a history, or the person knows that the dog is dangerous, then sort of the second portion of the statute allows you to sue for all kinds of things. Hmm. And we've had, with the merging of that statute, you know, there are a number of commercial entities out there, you know, your PetSmarts and your Home Depots and your Bass Pro Shops, all those different places that allow you to bring your dogs in. They sometimes will create a dangerous condition by allowing these dogs to be on premises. So someone that has a dangerous dog comes on the premises, that dog bites someone, and then you've got several defendants that you've got to think about: the owner of the dog, the people that allow that dog on the premise, what they knew about.
I mean, I tell people all the time, just because through the years we've done a show and we've talked about this before, I said, man, anytime you take your dog to a public place, you realize you're rolling the dice. And you may know your dog and your dog's never shown, but, you know, especially in these stores, I think where a kid, maybe a small kid, comes around now. So he's eye to eye with the dog. Right. The dog's not used to that. That scares the dog, or, you know, pulls the dog's tail, whatever, and bites the kid.
Correct.
Man.
Yeah.
And you're in a mess.
Right. And we've had a number of those sorts of cases over the years. And what ends up happening mostly is exactly that, that there's a chance meeting of a child and a dog. It's normally on the corners of these aisles, or it's normally where the child has startled the dog, or the dog is just really tense because of the situation they're in, and they react by biting somebody. And you just don't want
And it
that.
May even start with a dog fight, like two dogs
sure.
getting in. Then the people reach yep. in to stop, and man.
Yeah, that's exactly right. We've had
that's never going to turn out good most of the time.
No,
yeah.
it does not. I mean, there's always a human that ends up with some sort of bite. And unfortunately, you know, there's also situations where animal control gets involved. People maybe get cited. We've dealt with those. I've got a case right now that's coming in this week where the person was bitten and the owner was cited, and they're trying to figure out if there's any rabies issues and the dog's quarantined. I mean, it's just, they're more complicated than people realize.
So yeah.
that's certainly sort of the aspect of the premises liability, you know, and relating to all of these claims, especially both the motor vehicle and the premises claims. If the government entity is involved, you have to make sure that you understand the Governmental Immunity Act and whether or not that applies to your mm-hmm. particular claim. Because let's say a police officer is driving down the road or going over the speed limit and they're chasing someone and they don't have their lights and sirens on, they hit somebody, they still have an obligation to pay that person. But if they have the lights and sirens on, then they probably don't. So it's really pretty complicated relating to how the governmental entities work. And then you have, you know, you have to make sure that you put them on notice within 182 days of the event. Otherwise, you lose jurisdiction. So there's lots of things that people need to think about. Even if you're not sure who's caused your injury, mm-hmm. that you talk with us so that we can talk through the issues and figure that out.
Right. Yeah. Again, Kevin Flesh is with us. It is Flesh Law, 303-806-8886. Always a free initial consult, as I mentioned at the beginning of the show. Product liability, what does that look like? Is that just... how's it from a legal term? What does that mean for people? Product liability.
Yeah. So what? In general, if somebody gets hurt, they believe they were hurt because of a manufactured item. You know, and it can run the gamut. You hear about pharmaceuticals a lot. We see all the advertisements relating to those sorts of things because they become a class, and those classes then go through the system as an entire group. But you can also have devices, medical devices, and we've seen those. Mm-hmm. And again, something, you know, we had a bunch of cases relating to vaginal mesh cases and some of the other
gastric stuff. Oh, yeah, I remember that a few years back.
Yeah, exactly. So all of those sorts of cases kind of went through the system. You've got the talcum powder cases. You've got the Roundup cases. All of those sorts of cases that are bundled together in specific districts of the federal system because mm-hmm. they become federal cases. But smaller cases, we've had strange cases. Like we had a case with a Toyota truck a few years ago that it had an accelerator problem, and it caused injury to my client. He had an accident and blew out an eardrum, and so it was a weird mechanism of injury as to what took place, but it was clear that the vehicle didn't work properly, and that caused problems. And then you just have all sorts of other... sort of product, and that kind of falls into the food allergy stuff too, where you go to a restaurant and you have a peanut allergy, for example, and they don't tell you correctly relating to what's in the menu and what's in the ingredients. I just finished a case up with that, which is also a very interesting dynamic because Colorado has specific statutes relating to what needs to be in menus and what needs to be told to you, and whether you are completely put on notice. So those sorts of things, it's sort of an intersection between premises liability and also mm-hmm. product liability because they're creating a meal. So it's a product. So, and then, you know, if you think that you've got a problem with something in the way of a product that has caused you injury, you want to make sure that you get together with a lawyer right away. So you'd want to call us right away so that we can do some investigation. Because sometimes it may be two different ways that these cases go. They could be there isn't a big enough class so that mm-hmm. they combine them, and then you're pretty good. Or there could be a class that's already been established, and then you'll want to get in contact with the lawyers handling that class. So you could come to me. For example, we've had cases where, especially the pharmaceutical stuff, where people come in and they'll be like, oh, I want you to handle this case. And I look at it and I determine that there's liability, but it isn't something that we really will handle very well because there's already a class that's been established.
Gotcha.
Then we'll refer them to that those lawyers that are dealing with that class.
But get back to free consult. That's what it's there for.
Exactly. And we have a conversation.
It's worth a call.
That's exactly right. I've also handled cases where the claims are in the class, but there's still value in us being involved in it. And so we'll bring those. I had a couple of cases a few years ago of the same sort of injury relating to the same product. We brought those cases to a larger class, and then we moved that through the process.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's. But they're very. There was something that you want to talk with us about. You don't really want to do it on your own because it is complicated relating to not only the statute of limitations, but also just the manner in which you have to prove those things.
Right.
The most recent case I had was a lithium battery that blew up. Somebody was using it was a battery charger. He got to us really quickly. He had some really significant injuries. We did some research relating to the product. It didn't seem that there was a class of individuals, so we ended up just suing on his behalf, but we ended up resolving that case after we got through about half of the litigation. Had to get experts relating to lithium batteries, learned a lot about lithium batteries, which is interesting. They're, you know, obviously they're really stable, but when they become unstable, they become quite dangerous.
Right.
I can understand why airlines don't want them in their holds because they can cause some significant damage in the way that they don't blow up, but they certainly melt and cause significant heat and discharge of energy.
So, is workers' comp type stuff sort of under this and sort of not?
Yeah. So workers' comp generally by itself, so the concern for workers' comp is how did you get injured? The most important thing relating to the workers' comp is, first of all, you were injured on the job. So that becomes a workers' compensation claim. Then the issue is, how were you injured? Was it a fellow employee? Was it something that was managed by the employer? Most likely, if those two things have happened, if your injury was related to something that another employee did, or it was something that was managed by your employer, you know, let's say you work in an office building like you're in today.
Right.
And the office building is managed by your employer. They take care of everything within the building relating to any sort of dangerous condition or maintenance of the building.
Mm-hmm.
If you get hurt in the building, then most likely it's a workers' comp claim only. Where workers' comp sort of intersects with other types of law that you may be able to bring a claim against is in the event that a third party is injected into the fact pattern relating to how your injury occurred. I'll give you some examples. You're on a job. This is a real case that I had. My client had his son with him on the job site. They were working on remodeling a restaurant up in Summit County. It was a two-story restaurant, and they had ladders from a third party. They had another subcontractor in there that they were using their ladders.
Okay.
Their ladders weren't maintained, and the ladder broke when his son was on the ladder almost to the second floor, and he dropped about 12 feet and had some significant injuries. Now, if my client had been taking care of the ladder and it was their own ladder, he wouldn't have had a claim against anyone because that was his own fault and it was his son. But because a third party, another subcontractor, allowed them to use that ladder and they assumed that the ladder was in good condition before it broke, we had a claim against that third party. We also had a claim against the restaurant owner for not making sure who exactly was on the premises and whether or not there was a dangerous condition with a child on the premises. And so there were a couple of different people that we could make claims against for premises liability, and we did make a claim against them. We also had situations where you're in a car, you drive around and sell all day long.
Right.
And you're driving around, and part of your job is to drive. So you get into a car accident, someone else is at fault, that third party is at fault, you still can make a workers' comp claim for your medical expenses and for your lost wages relating to the time period while you're on, you know, any disability relating to those injuries. But you also can make a claim against a third party for causing you injuries. That third party claim is actually a little bit better claim in the sense of reimbursement because workers' comp, you really don't get non-economic damages, so pain and suffering damages, whereas a regular motor vehicle accident, you do.
Right.
That claim is worth more because of the ability for us to get you more compensation. So if you're in a car accident while you're at work, you probably have a couple of things going on, and it becomes more complicated, that's where you need to call us and talk right away so that we can help you through that process.
Right, right. We got a text, and it kind of what led me to this topic for you today. We got a text this week saying a guy got hurt, a contractor, in a person's house.
Yep.
What is that?
Yeah, so the person is there working on somebody's house. If it turns out they were hurt because of a dangerous condition that the landowner knew about or should have known about and didn't protect that that contractor from,
right,
you have a claim against the landowner.
Okay.
If it's just straight up, let's say the person was working there and he caused his own injury.
Yeah, fell off a ladder.
Fell off a ladder. Then it's just a workers' compensation.
Okay. And he can't do anything against the homeowner.
Most likely not. It's a fact-determined analysis. We've got to understand, can we make a claim against the landowner for some sort of dangerous condition?
Okay.
Did they contribute to the injury somehow by their negligence?
Right, right. And people should just bring that up. You should make sure when you hire a contractor that they have insurance.
Yes.
Right?
You absolutely want to make sure they have regular insurance for liability, and you also want to make sure if they have employees that they have workers' compensation, because you don't want them to come back after you with some sort of claim.
Yeah, and even though they might not win, it could be a hassle.
Yes, it's absolutely going to be a hassle.
Yeah.
And it's more than you want to deal with.
Right. We talked about this one in depth a few weeks ago, wrongful death type deal.
Yep.
That falls under this as well, right?
Yeah, so you can have wrongful death by itself. There's a statute for wrongful death as to who can make the claim and when they can make the claim. And then it depends on what sort of cause it is. So it could be a negligence claim, could be a medical malpractice claim, causing someone's death through malpractice. Still negligence, but it's a professional negligence. So you have to have another doctor review all the medical records, give you the opinion that they fell below the standard of care. Could be a car accident, mm-hmm. right? Again, the other driver caused injury. We've got the case that down in El Paso County with regard to a friend of yours that
right.
got hit by those folks that were street racing. You know, those sorts of things that you deal with, it's still a wrongful death case, but the basis of it may be because of a car accident. And then car insurance would cover potentially their other insurance if they had any relating to a maybe a liability, an umbrella policy, or maybe a homeowner's policy, depending upon what you can say. Relating to who was driving the vehicle and whether they had permission, and mm-hmm. that sort of thing. So those sorts of analyses all go relating to the wrongful death because someone has died, and
right.
you're saying that it was done by someone else's negligence.
Mm-hmm. So is this a fair way to phrase it? If you get injured by the fault of someone else, it's worth a call?
It is. And even if you don't, so we get calls, another good example, if we get calls about people that were injured by a phantom driver. They hit and run. We haven't been able to figure out who it was, but they've documented that it definitely was a case where they were hit and then the person left the scene. If you have underinsured, uninsured motorist coverage, you'll be able to make a claim against your own insurance company mm-hmm. for those sorts of claims. People don't really think about that a lot of times. If you're living with a family member inside your house and they have a UM/UIM
right.
portion of their policy, you can make a claim against their policy, even though they weren't at all involved
sure.
in the accident. So it's worth a phone call. It's worth 5-10 minutes. We talk about the case, see if there's something we can do, and then hopefully point you in the right direction.
Sure. And do that early.
Early.
Make the phone call early.
Right away.
Okay. It helps everything.
Yeah, you don't want to be doing it, you know, while you're still injured in the midst of mm-hmm. the event. But call us a few days later, and then let's sit down and chat about
yep.
it.
Yeah. Kevin, we appreciate it.
Thank you.
That's Kevin Flesh, Flesh Law, 303-806-8886. As I mentioned earlier, always a free initial consult. And once again, we have our Flesh Law text line. If you have a question, send me a text, 720-201-8585.
Call now for a free consultation with Flesh Law, 303-806-8886, 303-806-8886, or visit fleshlawfirm.com. That's FLESCH, fleshlawfirm.com. A proven team dedicated to your legal needs.
The views and opinions expressed on KLZ 560 are those of the speaker and do not necessarily reflect those of Crawford Broadcasting, the station, management, employees, associates, or advertisers. KLZ 560 is a Crawford Broadcasting God and Country station.
How much do you need to lower your monthly mortgage payment? $200, $300, $400 or more? As rates decline, take AIM, Affordable Interest Mortgage, 720-895-0500. Over 24 years of saving Coloradans money. Low rates, lower payments, less costs. What makes us different is we listen. As an independent mortgage broker, we shop the top lenders to save you the most. Affordable Interest Mortgage, 720-895-0500. Want to purchase your next home? You can't qualify unless you sell your current home? Let us show you how to get the down payment out of your current home, qualify for the new one, and then sell yours for the most. Affordable Interest Mortgage, 720-895-0500. So you want to buy a home. Let us show you loans that can save you money, low down payment, first-time home buyer specials, fixed rates in the fours with buy-downs. Call for details, 720-895-0500, or apply now at AIMortgage.net. That's Affordable Interest Mortgage, where it's all about you. Regulated by DORA, NMLS, 217-147, Equal Credit Lender.
Zip around the neighborhood, commute to work, or ride the trails on an e-bike. Hi, I'm Randy Kranzi, founder of eBike of Colorado. E-bikes are electric bikes that are fun and easy to ride. Pedal Assist technology flattens the steepest hills. At eBike of Colorado, we have 14 major brands to choose from, and our expert staff will find you the perfect bike. Just try it. Take a free test ride at eBike of Colorado in downtown Louisville next to the historic grain elevator. Open 7 days a week from 10 a.m. to 7 p.m. Learn more at ebikeofcolorado.com. Just try it.
This is AM 560 KLZ, your home station.
Haystack Help Radio brings you Your Legacy, Your Way, the show that puts you in control of your future. Hosted by Scott Whatley and featuring estate planning attorney Carolyn Duncan, this program is your go-to source for everything you need to know about protecting your assets, your family, and your legacy. Whether it's a will, a trust, or a full estate plan, if you don't decide, the state will decide for you. Attorney Carolyn Duncan brings the experience you need to help you gain peace of mind and avoid costly legal pitfalls. So ask yourself, what kind of legacy do I want to leave behind? Don't wait for a crisis before you plan. Now here's Your Legacy, Your Way with your hosts, Scott Whatley and Attorney Carolyn Duncan.
Welcome to Your Legacy, Your Way. My name is Scott Whatley. We are glad you are with us. Carolyn Duncan joins us. She is our exclusive estate planning attorney. You can check out her website at duncanlegal.com. Her number, 303-394-2358. And with that, we'll welcome our exclusive estate planning attorney, Carolyn Duncan. You know, I think back when COVID started. Mm-hmm. And that was, if you remember, that was like a week or so, I think, right before. And then we're thinking, okay, March Madness, they canceled that, which that you knew it had to be something a little was going to happen to cancel that. That's a big money deal, right? Yeah. And then you were thinking, okay, this will probably be just a few weeks of something. And then, oh my, you want to talk about something that changed our world.
And it did. and it wasn't only the basketball, but, I mean, the college football season, the college baseball. It just was.
Everything.
Yeah.
It was such an insane time. And I think that, I don't know about you, but it just seemed like going through that was just so crazy. I remember going to grocery stores, of course, and, you know, have to wear a mask. Man, I tell you, and I hated that. Victoria was getting on me all the time. You got to remember, you're on the radio. You can't go in there going, I'm not wearing that. I hated that. Yeah. Oh, man.
You know, I don't think that bothered me. And even when they kind of eased up and said, hey, you don't have to, in my office at that time, I'm like, hey, we don't have to wear masks, but if we have a client coming in and they're wearing a mask, guess what? Mm-hmm. We're going to honor what they want, and we're going to wear a mask.
Sure.
We're, you know, kind
too
of
bad
deal.
We didn't invest in Zoom before then, because think about how that world changed.
Well, and some things a state planner just can't do over Zoom.
Right, yeah.
I can't put that pen to that piece of paper.
Right, yeah.
But, yeah, I am glad those days are over by all means.
No
but, you know, it's like, okay.
Glad we're through it, for sure.
Yes.
Well, hey, if this is your first time to join us, welcome. We're here every week at this time with Carolyn, and I'll be honest, we try to approach this from every angle in the world. The number one, to get our listeners to understand how important it is to have certain documents in place. not only can it avoid some legal hurdles in the future for your family, but also the stress, Carolyn, it creates for families when things aren't in place. You've seen it both ways.
Mm-hmm.
You've gotten the calls where everything was planned, and hey, sure, there's grief and there's sorrow for what happened. Somebody lost their life. But, you know, the family went through things much easier than those that didn't have it planned.
Right, right. I think no matter what you do in terms of your estate, whether it's a will, whether it's a trust, you know, whatever it is, I think having the open discussion, it always seems to go smoother.
Mm-hmm.
You know, as opposed to, well, what am I supposed to do? I don't know what they have and all of that. And it's, I just find it's easier if you know where things are and you don't have to go, oh my God, there's six filing cabinets. You mean I have to go through all six of those filing cabinets?
Right.
Yeah, I think that doesn't help.
Yeah, for sure. So today we're going to take it this way, all right? Our topic, when someone passes away, you know, and they have a will, and let's take it that, and then we're going to maybe approach the other way when someone passes away, you know, and they don't have anything, all right? So when they have a will, first of all, let's say you should ask, you know, your parents, whatever the case may be, where is it, right? should we start there, you know, so we know. Have you ever had that situation?
Yes.
People have called you and go, hey, look, my husband, daughter, my wife, and we did this, but I have no idea where it is. And
you know, I've had that phone call where it's like my brother passed away, and we've been recording what he wants. And I'm like, well, that's really nice. It kind of gives you direction, but it's not going to help a whole lot with what's going to happen.
So did they mean like a voice recording?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
And then she's going, well, you know, he talked about doing a will, and I'm going, oh, okay. I was somewhat surprised within like a week or so that a will did show up. You know, she goes, I found it, and it's like, okay, you know. She filed it on her own with the court, and then I was looking at it, and I'm going, wow, I'm kind of surprised the court signed off on this.
Right.
Because it was one of those do-it-yourself wills, and, you know, not putting them down, but on this one, it's like you always want a will to be self-proving, which means it's signed in front of two witnesses and a notary, so the court is automatically going to accept it, going, okay, yeah, here we have the two witnesses. The witnesses are saying, yes, this person said it's their will. I watched them sign it. Then I signed my name, and the notary is notarizing everyone's signature. Mm-hmm. And so when I looked at this will, and I'm going, well, it's notarized, but there's no witnesses.
Right.
And I thought, for sure, at the minimum, the court should have said, well, you know, we need to have a hearing on this because it's not self-proving. And so we have to prove that this really is his will.
Right.
And it's not only under Colorado law. I probably could say it's the law in all 50 states. It's two witnesses and a notary make it self-proving.
Okay.
And court just signed off on it and said, here you go, personal representative. And I really, when I first saw the will before the court issued the order, because one, didn't realize my client filed it on her own. It's like, oh, isn't that what you're paying me for?
Oh, really? Oh, okay. That's interesting.
It was interesting.
Right.
And then it's like, going, oh, now I got to go in and fix it because you didn't put all the names. And, you know, it was really, could you just let me do my job?
Mm-hmm.
And it's worked out once we kind of got on that plane. But I didn't see that one coming.
Right.
But I was surprised that the court issued the order appointing the personal representative without witnesses on that will.
Interesting. Wow. So when we say filed the will, so when someone passed away, I just want to kind of lay out the steps. You have to take, is this the legal steps? You take that and you file it with a probate court?
Yes. So there's actually two.
And does each county have their own probate court?
No. Denver is a dedicated probate court.
Okay. All right, so no matter what.
And it's funny because Denver, who has a dedicated probate court, right now attorneys are complaining about how long it is taking for Denver to get anything out. I mean, it's taking anywhere 30 to 60 days easily.
I'm surprised
to get
at
something.
That. I mean, to be honest with you.
And it's like going, oh, my gosh. But there's two ways that you get the will to the probate court. So like I said, Denver's a dedicated probate court. Arapahoe County doesn't have a dedicated. So within the district court, a judge, they have a probate registrar, and then they appoint this judge that you're handling probates right now. They're not dedicated. They could also be doing criminal or could be doing family law or whatever, but you're the probate judge, and they kind of switch them out. So it's not dedicated like the one that's in Denver.
Right.
Kind of deal. But if you have a will and you don't think that you have to probate it, then what you're doing, the law says within, I'm going to say it's within 10 days after death, but that's not a hard line. And even the 10 days, my brain may not be right on that, but my brain is going, it's 10 days. But it, in my mind, it's not a hard and fast rule because I hope when I pass away in the first 10 days, my loved ones aren't looking for my will. You know, it's kind of like, hey, kind of deal. But it's if you don't have to probate, and I can explain reasons why you might not have to, then you're lodging the will. And by the using the term, I'm lodging the will, then you're saying, I have an original will, and by law, I'm giving it to you, but we don't expect to have to probate, have any assets to probate.
Okay.
So,
And does that mean because everything's kind of been assigned to different
people?
Yes,
and there's ways to get that done.
Okay.
You know, so in that instance, then it's kind of like that will is your safety net. So, for example, you could have a 401k or an IRA, and you can have a designated beneficiary. Well, anything that has a designated beneficiary is not a part of the probate estate. It passes outside probate. Very common for life insurance, bank accounts, IRAs, things like that, where there's a designated beneficiary. Okay, so you're like, oh, nope, don't need to probate those items. Hmm. If you have real property, depending on the situation, the relationship, you might not have to go to probate court over that. So if you are husband and wife, and you have own the real property together, and it's a joint right of survivorship, well, okay, it goes to the survivor upon death. And then at that point, what we do is in the clerk and recorder's office, not probate, clerk and recorder's where they do the deeds, we file a copy of the death certificate and a supplemental name affidavit that connects the death certificate to a specific warranty deed. Because usually on a death certificate, they use all three full names kind of deal. And a lot of times on a deed, you'll see a middle initial. So we'll say Jane, Susie, Joe is the same person as Jane, J, Joe.
Right. Okay.
And that is listed on this warranty deed that was recorded on this date under this file number. So we're connecting that death certificate to that. That deed.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. That works great for husbands and wives. It doesn't work for, ooh, dad died first, now mom died. Oh, now I'm going to probate because there's no joint right of survivorship with the children. That's only with the spouse.
Right.
So then it could, at that second level, go into probate. Another way to avoid probating the house, if let's say you're not married but you have a child, you can do a beneficiary deed, right? That says, hey, I own this house, and upon my death, I want it to transfer to my child. The problem with a beneficiary deed is in big, bold language, it has to say, yes, and this beneficiary deed can void your right to receive any Medicaid services that you might need for long-term care.
Oh, wow.
And so it's like, oh, that's not a big one. And so don't see too many of them here. Mm-hmm. And the reason that makes a difference in Colorado is we are an expanded recovery state for Medicaid. And they can go after probate assets, right? But the fact that you did a beneficiary deed in which your child is receiving it for not fair market value or anything, and had you not done this deed, we could sell your house and we could pay Medicaid back.
Gotcha.
So okay. Medicaid is a federal program, but each state does it differently.
Of course, the government's got to make it hard.
I'm telling you. And so the fact that we're an expanded recovery state, it can be worse than just a recovery state, mm-hmm. you know. So it's like we got more rules.
Right.
I just heard some statistics. There's like 37 expanded recovery states and all that. I'm like, okay, but Colorado is one of them. So I don't see that many beneficiary deeds.
Right. Do you have a certain amount of time? If someone wants to contest a will, is there a certain timeline after death you have 30 days, a year, 6 months, or something to contest a will?
I know you can do that. And my gut is telling me you at least have up to the 12 months because creditors have up until 12 months after the date of death.
So that would make sense.
You know, so I think it would be along the same lines.
Okay.
And that's where if you don't lodge the will, that it does become a problem because then you're going to have a sibling or whoever is then going to say, hey, Susie over here has the will and she won't do anything. Judge, force her to submit the will to the court. I've had it happen. Well, here's the will. And they never filed a probate. It's like, go to town.
Right, you know.
And you know the one sibling's like, "Oh no, that's a forgery," and I'm like, "You wanted the will, submitted to the probate court. We submitted it to the probate court. Can't make us probate it."
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that one really went nowhere. But that's why lodging the will. You know, you have the 10 days, but again, I've submitted them way after the 10 days,
right?
And you know, as long as no one's really fussing, or if they do fuss, say, hey, yeah, here you go.
Mm-hmm.
Here's a copy.
Right. You're listening to Your Legacy Your Way with Attorney Carolyn Duncan. Again, her number, 303-394-2358. Carolyn does offer a free initial consult, half hour with you. And, hey, that's a good time maybe to just come in, meet her, let her know what you're trying to accomplish, and then she will be glad to help you. And again, that number is 303-394-2358. Okay, so the court then validates the will. They officially appoint that personal representative.
It's not so much that they're validating the will.
Okay.
I think that's a separate action.
Okay.
So, for example, I don't do formal probates because that involves a judge making an order, and that's usually a lot of times people are fighting over stuff like that. And if I really wanted to be a probate litigator, I'd still be a divorce lawyer.
Right.
You know, because that's all you're basically doing. There are circumstances where you might want to submit it formally to get something established and you're not going to fight, but usually someone's anticipating litigation.
Mm-hmm.
Informal probate is where you file an application to the court saying, hey, here's a will. I'm named the personal representative. Here are all the people that have a potential beneficiary stake within the estate. And please appoint me as the personal representative. And if you are named in the will and you're the top spot, you may have 5 siblings, but they can't overrule you. Now, they can come in and say, oh, man, you're doing a terrible job. You're not the right person. That's different.
Right.
Now we're getting into probate litigation.
Okay. Right.
But if you're named in the will and you're the top person, then it's not like the person named number 3 can just come in and say, well, I want to do it. You don't even need those people below you their permission because mm-hmm. you are the top dog.
Right. And we've said this before, that person then has that legal fiduciary
duty.
Responsibility mm-hmm. to do the best interest of the estate.
Yes, not what's in their own best interest, right. but looking out for the estate. So a great example of that is, let's use a house. If there's a house and I want to purchase the house from, you know, pay off my siblings, and I'm the personal representative, then the fiduciary duty means, hey, we have to figure out what is the fair market value. Mm-hmm. Now, if we have three siblings, you know, we can agree it's X based on what we want. We don't necessarily have to get an appraisal. You could get a real estate, you know, where they do the comps and they go, yes, right. I've done this, and in my mind, it's worth X dollars. You could do an appraisal, or you could agree.
Just on a number.
On a number that, right. hey, the three of us agree. We're happy mm-hmm. kind of deal. So, yeah, that's where you're coming in, and you can't just say, yeah, this house is worth $600,000 and I'll pay you $150,000.
Right.
Because you're then taking away from the other beneficiaries.
Right, right. Now, are creditors notified then from what you do there when you once you file that then? Does the court notify them? Is it your responsibility to notify creditors? How does that work?
Well, it depends.
Okay.
What happens is we distinguish between known creditors and unknown creditors. So a known creditor is a mortgage because you're getting a statement. It's a credit card because you're getting a statement. It's your HOA annual assessment. Okay, I get a statement once a year that says, here's my annual assessment. I'm being notified. They're known that they're out there.
Okay.
Unknown creditors are, okay, my last illness, I was transported in an ambulance to the hospital. Well, we know I went in an ambulance, but until they submit their bill, we don't know which one.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So for the unknowns, what we do is we do a notice of publication. It runs once a week in the newspaper, and then it says 4 months from the date of the first publication, here is your claims bar date. So if we were looking at March and got something done in March, then, you know, you can go, okay, April, May, June, July, okay, this date's going to be sometime in July. You can tie known creditors to that, but you're doing a notice to known creditor and saying, we just did this with the newspaper, here's your copy, and you're trying to limit them to that same four-month period, that claims bar date.
Right.
Right? But with a known creditor, they have 12 months from the date of death. You know they're out there. Doesn't mean you have to wait 12 months to pay them. Like if you get a credit card and it's got, it's got $3,000 on it. You go, oh, there's plenty of money to pay all the bills. Here's your $3,000. Mm-hmm. Well, then you're done.
Right.
Yeah.
I remember back when newspapers were a thing, I remember looking through and seeing notices, you know, somebody died, if you're a creditor, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah. I remember that.
What you know, I always thought the ones that said, hey, I am no longer responsible for anybody's debts but my own, and blah, blah, blah. I always remember thinking, I wonder if that really does any good, especially if it's a joint debt.
Now, do those known creditors have to be paid before any money can go to?
Yes. So here's how it happens, and it really depends on how big your pot is, right?
Right.
You need to do your inventory because creditors are entitled to see what you have if they're not being paid in full. And so the inventory is 90 days after the date of appointment, and it's your best guesstimate. It's like if you're going to put the house on the market, but you don't really know what it's going to sell for because you don't know until you get a contract, then you're putting your guess estimate of, I think this house is worth X. If there's an investment account or something, well, that's pretty easy. I have a statement that says it's worth this. So we do our best, and it's sometimes it's a moving target, mm-hmm. you know, cars. Can you really get down to the penny what a used car is worth kind of deal? And so then what you do is you start doing your money in, money out, your accounting. And it's sometimes confusing to people go, hey, but I'm the only beneficiary. I'm an only child. And it's like, well, the law doesn't say you only have to do this stuff if there's more than one beneficiary. What you're really doing is for potential creditors to complain. So right. if you're going, there's not enough money in the pot, then the first thing they're going to do is go, well, I want to see the inventory, and I want to see the accounting, because if you paid this credit card in full, yet I'm not getting paid in full, mm-hmm. we're now going to have a problem.
Right.
And so you're doing some of these things to protect yourself down the road.
Right. So last few minutes here, but so a will will name who inherits what, correct?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
It names guardians for minor children.
Yep.
If done correctly. Okay. And it appoints a personal representative.
Correct.
Okay. But it doesn't avoid probate.
It doesn't avoid probate. You okay. may do other things that avoid it, but it doesn't avoid probate.
And then it doesn't handle incapacity?
No. It only acts okay. at death.
Okay. We talk about that just about every show because that's huge. And it doesn't control beneficiary designated assets.
Correct.
Correct. Okay. A lot to know here, folks. Carolyn Duncan can help you. And you know what? Thursday, March 26th, from 9 to 11 a.m., you can have coffee with Carolyn. All right? All you have to do is, hey, shoot her an email, carolyn@duncanlegal.com. You can give her a call, 303-394-2358. And office will get you a link for that. This is going to be virtual online. And, hey, just a chance to meet Carolyn, let her go through some things. And it's going to be about three easy steps to protecting your legacy. The name of our show is Your Legacy, Your Way. And, Carolyn, just give us a touch of what that means. Yeah,
yeah, what we're really going to be going through is basically the differences between having a will-based plan, having a trust-based plan, and having an asset protection plan, which is what really protects your assets, and it's an irrevocable trust, and when you use it and how can it be used and how does it protect you, that if you are in a nursing home and your family has used Medicaid to help pay for it, how Medicaid can't come back and take it back. Mm-hmm. And of course there's rules around all that, but
right,
that's
sure.
it in a nutshell.
Right. And again, that is Thursday, March 26th from 9 to 11. And like I say, the office number, you can just give her a call, 303-394-2358, or shoot her an email, carolyn@duncanlegal.com. Don't put this off, all right? Call today. Hey, free initial consult, and it just makes everything so much easier, relieves a lot of stress for you, your family. And again, we want your legacy, your way, to be the way it is. So, Carolyn, thanks for your time. We'll look forward to our show next week.
Great. Thank you.
Thanks for being with us today for Your Legacy, Your Way. Once again, our phone number, 303-394-2358. Have a great rest of your day. Leave it right here on KLZ 560.
Views and opinions expressed on KLZ 560 are those of the speaker and do not necessarily reflect those of Crawford Broadcasting, the station, management, employees, associates, or advertisers. KLZ 560 is a Crawford Broadcasting God and Country station.